WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. You know what it is. It's The Big Picture. Derek Gary and Chase Blaine with you until 9 o'clock tonight. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. Should we give Chase Blaine a microphone tonight or just make her shout in the background?
Let me on the... Oh, wow, it's on.
We'll give Chase Blaine a microphone.
Oh, I think, Derek, you know, that's really thoughtful of you. I've had a rough day. I could use a microphone.
I don't need any Me Too Time's Up moments over here. Happy New Year. It's 2020.
It is.
We did our wrap-up.
This is 2020.
We did our wrap-up show last year. I've been thinking of throwing, like, the Barbara Walters... I don't know if you heard this or not, but... People offered her a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, to bring in the new year, yeah. Saying this is 2020.
To just show up and say this is 2020. And it's like, it is 2020. We have all the 20s.
Well, do you know what I love about this, though, is that, you know, Barbara Walters has been retired for a while.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, because it's 2020, she's on people's minds again. Like, if you go on Hulu, like, Barbara Walters Investigates is, like, one of the first things that you can watch as, like, suggested viewing.
Nice. Yeah, she was definitely trending, and they played the clips, but it's not the same as, you know, that would have been a great moment. I don't know why. Take the money. Maybe they didn't offer enough. You know, I'm sure somebody, like, dangled a six-figure paycheck in front of her to show up 5 seconds.
Because, I mean, like, I was going to say, like, every major station that was having some sort of broadcast tossed their hat in that ring. Well, and, of course, the closest that we got was Sherry O'Terry doing her... Barbara Walters impression with
good.
Anderson Cooper. Yeah. And that's the thing, is Anderson Cooper was like losing his mind laughing over it.
Well, Anderson was pretty drunk by that point.
I was going to say, I think that was more Yeager laughing at Sherry O'Terry than Anderson Cooper laughing at Sherry O'Terry.
I didn't find her that funny, but I wasn't nearly as drunk as Anderson was. So, you know, I should have been doing Yeager shots along at home. I guess that's the point of that show. Anyway, it is a new year. It is a new decade, according to some, and I'm not going to die on that hill.
I was going to say, don't die on that hill, D.
I'm not going to die on that hill. And we got changes. Changes. It's always change.
And the times, they are changing.
So for the last decade, it's been 2 hours of news and nonsense, pretty much. And you know, there's stuff going on. You know, I don't want to go too deep into in-house matters, but there's stuff
in-house
going on
matters.
Behind the scenes. So we're going to make a shift in the programming on this show. And what we're going to do for the foreseeable future is you're going to get two shows. It's two shows in one.
Two shows in one.
You're still going to get like the big picture, local news, some national news, and all that. But we're also, I still don't have a finalized name for this yet. But our second hour for the foreseeable future, we're going to be talking about movies, because nobody around here is talking about movies, and you know it's high time.
It's true.
It's high time, and
I mean, well, as I was saying when we talked about this idea. Technically, it could just stay the big picture because movies are pictures.
Kind of maybe. I don't know. If I had the bigpicture.com, I'd be inclined to do that, but I don't.
I wonder if there is. I'm going to look into that.
You know, if there's ever been an underlying mission to what we do here, and there has been, by the way, for those of you who are paying attention, it's always been about critical thinking and learning how to approach things critically. It's gotten to a point with much of the news where we spend more time debunking the falsehoods and the nonsense than we do actually approaching things critically.
Yeah.
So I look at it and I say, you know, if you want to encourage critical thinking, why don't we start with something that everyone can objectively experience in the same way, and that is a movie. So if you don't like movies, you can, you know, wander off at 8 o'clock at night, because that's when we're going to start that part of things. If you do like movies, tell your friends, because I think you're going to find some interesting commentary, takes,
indeed,
recommendations.
And both, little known fact, both Derek and I actually have film degrees.
Yes. We're both, well.
I know, like, newsflash, you guys didn't know that about us. We're not just savvy political-minded folk.
We're both,
we're both movie nerds underneath.
I have been on every possible side of the camera. I have at varying times in my, well, I mean, not just as a student, but I've produced a short film. I have promoted film. I have been in a film.
I'm going to say, y'all, if y'all haven't already, check out School Ties. You can see a young strapping Derek in several scenes.
I have been a film critic. I have been the executive editor of a film magazine. So this is sort of like a through line in my life, and we always try and talk about movies around here when we can anyway. So I may as well use all of this stored knowledge for something.
Very true.
And, you know, talk about something other than whatever nonsense is coming off of the front page.
And boy, is there a plethora of nonsense on
what
the
do you got
page.
For local nonsense today, Shea Spillane?
Locals, actually, it's a story very close to my heart. And anyone else who's a Q-Town representing will feel the same. Developers behind a controversial proposal for a three-story building on the site of the former famous Beachcomber Club have withdrawn their plans from a state environmental review board so they can, quote, fully review and examine all concerns raised, end quote. A trio of developers submitted plans to the city and state last year detailing their intent to build a 7,000-square-foot building and pave an 89-spot parking lot at 797 Quincy Shore Drive, which is, for those of you who aren't familiar, overlooking Wollaston Beach, Quincy's main boulevard drag. The project was under review by the Massachusetts Environmental Policy Act office until developers withdrew the plans on Monday. The news comes 2 days after neighbors spoke out against the project in a Patriot Ledger article, citing concerns that the proposal would worsen the effects of coastal storms on nearby homes by paving over a property that now soaks up floodwaters. Anyone that's been to the Beachcomber parking lot knows that this is an absolute fact.
But wait, you just said parking lot, so it's already paved over.
No, the parking lot is sand.
Oh, okay.
It's packed sand, but sand. The resident group called Quincy Making Waves has been pushing for the lot to be turned into a park. Part of the reason, so for those of you who aren't familiar with the Beachcomber, it's famous. It's been there since 1959. Dropkick Murphys got their start at the Beachcomber. It was very controversial when the property was sold in the first place, but the thing, if you've ever been to Quincy Shore Drive, for those of you, I know we have a lot of North Shore listeners.
If you've ever been to Quincy Shore Drive, you took a wrong turn.
Shush.
And you need to get back on Route 3, is all I'm going to say.
But you can compare it to, like, Revere Beach. It's very much lots of, like, walk-up, clam stands.
Yeah. Your basic boardwalk beachfront parking.
And, with all the, like, slide into the seawall parking. And beyond the fact that, yes, I mean, there would be serious flooding issues because that parking lot, it purposely dips down. Like, that was one of the that was one of the ideas behind its conception and the way that it was, so that it could kind of get, because obviously during like a really big storm or a major blizzard, Beachcomber's not going to be open.
Right. No, because Quincy Shore Drive floods. And everyone knows that it floods.
But beyond that, too, I mean, like, the clam box has been there just as long as the Beachcomber has, and the clam box is still open. But in terms of just the experience of driving up Quincy Shore Drive, some giant three-story building, it's just not going to fly.
Did you see what they did to Revere Beach, Shay?
I did see that, and I'm in the camp of prevent what happened to Revere Beach to happen to Wollaston Beach.
I remember when none of that was there. I remember when that was still like wide open land from, you know, the old amusement park that had burned down and fallen down and fallen into disrepair. And in the late 80s and the early 90s, suddenly it was like beachfront condos.
And that's the thing, is that beyond just it ruining the ambiance, ruining the people who've lived there on that street for years, who don't have a giant building blocking their view of the ocean. Quincy Shore Drive, for those who aren't familiar, is a really convenient straightaway to get to Boston. It's one of the two paths you can use to get to the Neponset Bridge.
So you hit that rotary at the end of it and nothing's moving.
True. But I was going to say on the other side of the bridge, yeah, that thing's a nightmare. But adding a large, because it is intended to be condo complex, and adding that, I mean, Quincy's already gone up traffic-wise since they built up the downtown.
Gee, I wonder why.
It
Turns out you build hundreds of condos, they come with hundreds of cars. Who knew?
Very true. And they're not done, and they're not done building the giant parking garage yet. I was like, hey guys, maybe before you sold all those condos, would have been a good idea to like have places for the cars to go.
Yeah.
Like, because, you know, I grew up in Quincy, and being in Quincy Center, I know every savvy parking trick. You know what I mean? But
none of them work anymore.
It's a battlefield out there.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do, I mean, the plan, currently there is a park next to the Clam Box. And I do think that a similar project at the Beachcomber would be preferable.
There is zero chance. Zero chance.
That they're just going to give up.
That beachfront real estate is not going to be condoed.
Well,
it's just think about what you're asking.
But,
it's not going to happen.
But here's the thing. If you want to flip that over, they've got the MEPA up their butts about this. And who is going to pay? And like, it's really like, this is a huge roadblock, not being able to pay, like not being able to pay this parking lot. Who is going to pay for a luxury condo that has a dirt parking lot?
Some developer is going to come along, throw a bunch of money around, buy off the city council, and get it done. And that's reality. The only time I can think of waterfront real estate not being turned into condos or what have you is up at the head of Lake Quanapowhat, where there was a restaurant for many, many years. It was a Chinese restaurant. It was one of those places where the cops hung out waiting to pick up the drunks as they stumbled out of the place and got into their cars. And it shut down. They may have had their license revoked. It shut down. And because the town of Wakefield got sick and tired of dealing with drunk drivers all over the place.
Fair.
And it changed hands and was going to become a chain restaurant. And the community, which had always had a problem with restaurants in that area, finally were like, no, we're going to stop this. And because it was a small town and it was a piece of real estate that was, it's got a road on one side, a very busy road on one side, and a lake on the other. If you did anything to that existing structure, given all the changes in environmental laws, it was over. So they basically said, tear it down, put up a park, and that's what happened. So you now have a park that really, I'm not going to say nobody uses it, but given all of the people who are around Lake Quanapowhat on a given day, and if you live on the North Shore, you know what I'm talking about, it is probably the most underutilized piece of real estate near the lake.
We'll see. Okay, so that with that story in mind, that is why I think that if the community members make a big enough stink, that it will stop this from happening. Only because Quincy very much is divided into zones, if you will. Like, and some of them, you know, like Quincy Center, it's very like all different kinds of people, whatever.
There's the meth zone and there's the crack cocaine zone.
And the heroin zone. And all of them meet at the Quincy Center T station.
Yeah.
But Marymount, which is the neighborhood that is directly behind Quincy Shore Drive, those are like, this house has been in my family for generations, people.
Yeah.
Those are the people who like can trace their family living back there from when whoever came over from Ireland.
By the way, that house hasn't been updated in generations either.
Oh, so. Yeah. You drive through some parts of Marymount and like if you didn't see the cars, you'd think it was 1948.
Yeah. It's like Brooklyn, you know, post-war years.
But because of that, because it's an area like that, and like I said, not all areas of Quincy are like that. Like North Quincy's not really like that. Wollaston's not really like that. They're much more like, when you think of Quincy, like the urban type areas. Yeah. But Marymount is definitely like a small, very a small, very close-knit community and very seeped in tradition. And I think like I see this being a, we're going to keep making a stink until you give us what I want kind of situation.
We'll see what happens. Beachfront real estate.
I know.
Real tough to protect that these days.
True.
Real tough to protect that. In other housing news, courtesy of WBUR, Rent control brings big crowd to State House. Uh-oh. A Lynn woman told lawmakers she may have to move her family after a 35% rent increase. A Mattapan great-grandmother said she will go to court to fight a $700 rent hike that she cannot afford on a fixed income. A Chelsea college student worries about becoming homeless. The solution, they all said, is to revive local rent control options that were banned statewide by a 1994 ballot question, allowing their hometowns to place restrictions on how much landlords could hike costs. After kicking off with warnings from real estate industry leaders that rent control could stifle housing production, members of the Joint Committee on Housing heard hours of personal testimony Tuesday from activists. As soon as I hear the word activists, I tune out. And tenants worried that activists. Rising prices will force them out of their homes. So I'm not going to go into the sob stories here because...
I was going to say, I'm sure you have a lot of like... A lot of like, my family, I gave birth under the stairs.
This is a zero empathy situation for me, but we'll get to that in a minute. Two bills.
A zero empathy situation. If I had a nickel for every time that came out of Derek's mouth.
Two bills before the committee would allow cities and towns to implement rent control. One from Cambridge Representative David Rogers focuses on setting rent increase caps, allowing increases in line with the annual change in the consumer price index or the area, or 5% per year, whichever is less. Tenants would qualify for the protection if they earn 80% or less of the area median income. 80%! 80% of the area median income gets you rent control.
That seems high.
The median income is...
I would say the median...
In some of these communities is $75,000.
I was going to say it's like way more than most people make.
Tenants, the other bill co-filed by Cambridge Rep.
I made $75,000.
Mike Connolly and Boston Rep. Nika Elugardo includes other tenant protection tools. Progressive, there's another word I don't ever want to hear.
I was going to say, I can like feel your eyes roll in my head.
Progressive lawmakers leading the charge see the controversial idea as a valuable complement to another bill before the committee, which would let cities and towns impose fees on real estate transfers and use the revenue to expand affordable housing opportunities. Okay. Rent control. The governor has already said it's a non-starter. He won't sign it. And let's be thankful. This is one of those rare times when our governor has staked a position on something. And let's be thankful for that, because there is nothing the state could do that would be more disastrous than rent control. I remember the rent control days. And I remember when rent control was repealed in 1994. And I can tell you a big reason that rent control, it was a narrow vote. But I can tell you that one of the big reasons rent control was repealed in 1994 was because there were a bunch of very wealthy people over in Cambridge, including, I believe, a governor, who were basically subletting rent-controlled apartments to one another and rent-controlled houses to one another. So you had people who were in the top 10% of earners in the state living in essentially subsidized housing at way below market rates.
Yeah.
And the people in Cambridge were up in arms about it because they said, this isn't what rent control was meant to be. This isn't who it's for. Get the rich people out of here. And the rich people basically said, get off my lawn. Because there was no protection for that.
I can only picture Clint Eastwood saying that.
Here's
off my lawn.
Here's what happens if you pass rent control. Let me use Somerville as an example. Everyone who has the means will immediately condo their triple-deckers and sell them. And the faster you sell your triple-decker, the more money you're going to get for it. Because what you will have is a glut of homes coming on the market that will bring down overall property values.
Yeah.
Those who cannot afford to condo are going to let their buildings slip into disrepair as they try and milk maximum profit in a rent control atmosphere.
I was going to say, I mean... A lot of this really reminds me of the healthcare debate, because I remember when I was in Canada, I got hurt and I had to go to the hospital, and the care that I received was, I mean, the only thing it can be described at is substandard. And I remember coming home and talking to my brother about it, and he said, well, yeah, what is doctor's incentive to be like the best neurosurgeon. Like it's all coming from the same place. And it's the same sort of thing where it's like, if there's rent control, then what is the incentive of a landlord to fix that light in the hallway?
Exactly.
To fix the stairs, to paint the house when it starts to crack? Because all of that, I mean, a lot of times people think like in terms of rent, it's like, oh, it's just like we're the income for whoever owns this building.
Right.
But a lot of rent, I mean, that's the reason like I live in a condo. That's the reason I live in a condo. I pay condo fees. And it's not as much as rent would be, but it's still a significant amount of money. And you have to think about like with rent, a significant amount of that money is going into the place that you live.
Yeah. Let's acknowledge
that's the intention.
First of all, let's acknowledge that there is an affordable housing problem around here. Partly because Boston has become so expensive that the rich people who used to live in Boston are now spilling out into Cambridge and Somerville and Brookline. Mm-hmm. And the middle class people who are living in Cambridge and Somerville and Brookline are now spilling out into Arlington and Medford and Malden. And it keeps spreading outward. You need to have housing for people who don't make top incomes in any city.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, you have no one to run the coffee shops. You have no one.
No janitors.
No janitors. No electricians. No street cleaners. No teachers. Teachers can't afford to live in a lot of these communities. So you need to have affordable housing. You don't do that through rent control. Rent control will not create affordable housing. Rent control creates tenements. That's all it has ever... Rent control creates tenements. Yeah. It drives developers off because it takes away the incentive. No one's... If I have a choice between two communities and market rate housing in community A is worth 40% more than market rate housing in community B, I'm going to go build in community A because I want to maximize my profit from my development. This is why you don't see a lot of development in places like Lynn and Chelsea and Revere. Well, Revere's kind of coming around.
Yeah.
But you know the towns.
Yeah.
You have one near you and you drive through it and you're like, why does nothing ever change here? It's because market rate housing isn't profitable for anyone there. Or it isn't as profitable as it is two towns over.
Weymouth, sorry.
Yeah.
I had to sneeze.
Rent control aggravates that situation. Now, here's the other, and this is where, you know, I lose it with the activists. You don't have a right
that word activist really just ruins them already for you.
You don't have a right to live in that apartment. Okay? If you can no longer afford to live in your apartment, then you have been left behind. And you have been left behind because you are not earning the salary that everybody else in town is. You're either on a fixed income or you have a job that doesn't pay a lot or you're not working five jobs or whatever it is. Go move somewhere affordable. You don't have a right to be in that apartment. I don't care if you've been there for 30 years. I don't care if you've been there for 40 years. I don't care if everyone in the neighborhood knows you. No one has a right to live in any piece of property unless they own it. If you own it, and you own it outright, and you have zero debt, and the government tries to come along and take it away from you, then you have an argument.
Yeah.
If you rent, you have no claim to anything.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate, and, you know, this is the point where people will say, you know, I'm bigoted, or I'm racist, or I'm just cruel. No. I am somebody who has been on the other side of that business. And the simple reality is, rental property is rental property. And the people who own rental property are going to do anything and everything that they can to get as much value out of it as they can.
And it's
making money on rental property is not as easy as a lot of people think it is.
Oh, trust me, I know. Well, and typically, there's language, when you sign a lease, there's language within the lease that basically tells you you're signing your right away.
Yeah. You should have bought a condo.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's not necessarily a fair thing to say, and I recognize that. If you are renting, you have no claim to your home.
Well, and the tricky thing about this is that with the way the economy has been, with basically what my generation is facing is the very real possibility that everyone, like most people my age, will be renting for the rest of their lives. And I think that the argument for rent control there is just that it gives a 25 to 35 year old a prayer of a chance that maybe they'll be able to own someday.
You're better off staying at home saving that money. You are.
But I thought us millennials were supposed to get off our butts and not live with our parents.
Liz, if you're living with your parents to save money to buy a place, I'm all on board with that. I have no problem with that. But the solution needs to be mandates on affordable housing. And when they got rid of rent control, there was a rule passed that said for X number of market rate units you build, you have to build affordable housing. More market rate units you have in a development, the more affordable housing you need to include, whether it's Section 8 or subsidized or whatever it is. Developers have been finding ways around that rule since it was passed. Because if you're putting up a 15-story luxury condominium, one of the things that developers have discovered is that the people who want to buy those condos don't want poor people living in the basement. And they don't want to have to share their amenities with the poor, okay? You talk about problems with the rich people all day long, but if you're a developer, that's a hard reality that you need to consider. So a lot of communities set it up that, well, if you contribute to our affordable housing fund that never materializes into anything, we'll let you omit that requirement. Or the other classic, which is, you have the main entrance is for the rich people, and then around and back, you've got a separate entrance for the affordable housing people living in the basement, and they have no way of getting into the rest of the building. Those are the solutions that developers came to. Obviously, that's better than nothing if you get some affordable housing units.
Yeah.
But it's still a classist, horrible system to put people through.
I mean, yeah, and it's, I mean, the end of all of that is the rich keep getting richer and the poor stay poor. That's the one argument that I think can be made for rent control is to give people a chance, you know, because it's, I mean, I think about.
But the problem is that rent control does not create affordable housing. Rent control creates an incentive for less housing, less rental housing. Rent control reduces the available supply of rental housing in toto, which has a negative impact on housing prices because supply and demand dictates what the market rate is going to be. It discourages development and it creates tenements. These are all things that went away when we got rid of rent control. And keeping rent control off the books is the best path forward. Now, what we need is some sort of government commitment or public-private commitment to building affordable housing. I don't know what that looks like. I don't know where it comes from. But that's how you solve this, is you figure out, you know, how much affordable housing do we need in a given area?
That's
not with the idea that, you know, we're going to let the poor all flood into town and live here because we have nice benefits, but because we have people who work in the city that need housing.
That need, yeah.
How much housing do they need?
That's a fair point. Like, for example, so my sister lives in New York City and lives in Long Island City, which is an area of Queens that is just, I mean, you can throw a baseball at Manhattan. It's just on the edge of the East River. She lives in a really nice, like, luxury apartment building. But recently, just next to her, right next to the river, they built a building that is specifically, it's not low income housing, but it's specifically affordable housing for they actually, how they do it is based on the person's profession.
Right.
So the people who can live there are teachers, plumbers, like if you work in any sort of retail store in the area, And that, I think, is, I agree with you on that. I do, that I think is a good solution to, okay, so we don't have to have rent control. And the apartments are nice.
Yeah.
They're not probably up to par with what my sister's building or the buildings around it.
Yeah, there's no infinity pool on the 40th floor, but you know, it's a nice place to live in a nice part of Manhattan.
It's a clean place to live that does not involve them commuting from Jamaica, Queens to work at an elementary school in Long Island City.
Right.
And that, I remember when they were building that, I was like, oh my God, is it going to be another? But I remember just thinking that that was so wonderful. And I agree. It's, I mean,
that's a smart solution. That's the sort of thing I can get behind.
Basically, the housing should reflect the area. And that does not mean like, okay, Newton, I don't know, I can't imagine that anyone that works in Newton in a blue collar job lives in Newton.
No, but that's why you have the poor town next door. And but this is the way it works. You have the rich town. You get out in the suburbs, you have the rich town. We know what the rich towns are. Newton's one of the richest. You have the poor town next door. You know, for every Newton, I'm trying to think of what the poor town is next door to Newton.
That's what I'm looking up right now.
I can tell you, for Hamilton,
I mean, I guess Waltham, Watertown?
Yeah, Waltham, actually.
Yeah.
So for Newton, you have Waltham, because there are very affordable parts of Waltham. For Hamilton, which is the richest town in the state, you have Gloucester. And it's the people who service, run the stores and the donut shops and everything, for the people who live in the rich town, live on the other side of the town line. And it's the suburbs. So you can drive in. Or you can, or, you know, most of those suburbs have public transportation. You can take a bus. And it's easy for you to get to work. It's not like, you know, I'm living in Wilmington and I got to figure out how to get to Boston every day, which is what the reality is becoming for people at the bottom of the economic ladder.
Oh, absolutely.
Is that there's no place you can live anywhere around here.
Yeah, I mean,
we can't have that.
I was going to say, well, that's what, like, I used to, I thought about this a lot when I worked at a restaurant in Cambridge. And I worked at a restaurant in the Kendall area of Cambridge. And most of the people that I worked with were coming from at least three or four towns over.
Yeah.
And then, of course, but and the irony is, if they lived in the neighborhood, they could walk to work, but they couldn't do that, so they had to commute in some way. A lot of the places that people live did not have public transportation.
So they got to have a car.
So they have to have a car. And then once you get to that part of Cambridge,
there's no parking.
There's no parking. There was, we used to cover each other's tables so we could run out and fill a meter.
Yeah.
Like, and that's, I mean, and it's a, but the funny thing is about that, which is the one argument that I make for rent control, is that the servers who had been working there for several years all had apartments in the area that were affordable, but they had been living in those apartments for a decade.
Right. And they're only affordable until that building changes owners.
I was going to say, they're only affordable until that building changes owners, or God knows, until they move out.
Yeah.
New tenant comes in. Suddenly the rent is $500, $600, $700 more.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, it's, I have a foot in both camps. It's tough. It's just a tough situation.
But
it's,
I like,
spade is paid.
I like the New York solution, which is, we're going to create, you know, affordable housing for people who work in this neighborhood. And you have to prove that you work in the neighborhood. You have to prove that you work. You know, it's not just, hey, you know, we're providing shelter for the poor at taxpayer expense because we're a wealthy community. That's not, we have problems with congestion, and we have dim-witted city planners who think that getting rid of cars is somehow a good idea because, oh, everybody just lives in the city. No, they don't. And you just gave a perfect example of reality.
Yeah.
Cambridge is one of the chief offenders.
Yeah, absolutely.
In parking. Somerville is well on its way to getting there. And all of these communities are going to become islands full of rich people with no services and no way of getting anything done because you're driving all of the poor away. And you're driving all of the working class people away.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, I think about it in terms of this. So Somerville is a perfect example. When I lived in Somerville in 2012, my rent in a 3-bedroom, 1-bath apartment was $600 a month. I moved to to LA for 3 years. I came back. I moved to Somerville in, I want to say, I moved to Somerville in 2018. Yeah, 2018. My rent in a much worse three-bedroom, one-bath in a poorly maintained building in Winter Hill. Oh, that's what I should mention, is that I lived right off Highland Avenue when I lived there before. I moved to Winter Hill right by Broadway when I moved back. My rent was $850 a month, and when it came time to renew the lease, they upped the rent to $1,000.
Nice.
And that's ultimately, there were many reasons I moved out, but that was one of the reasons I moved out. And for those of you who aren't too familiar with Somerville, Winter Hill's the last little nook of Somerville other than East Somerville before you go outside of it, before it becomes Medford or Charlestown or Malden and or Cambridge. Well, Cambridge is on the other side, though. Cambridge is near Porter. But anyways, but the thing is, it was all of the people who lived in my area were people who had lived in Cambridge, and then Cambridge rent got too high, so they had to move to Davis and Porter and those areas of Somerville, and then the rent there got too high, so they had to. And that's when I ended up just moving back in with my mom for a while to save money, but before I kind of threw in the towel about finding another place to live, the only places I could afford were in Malden. When 10 years ago, nobody's talking about moving to Malden like it's a good idea.
Well, no, there was actually a surprising number of students moving into Malden and Melrose because you had the advantage of an MBTA community and drastically lower cost of living.
But like someone like me who's working in town, it's Malden. You're not looking in Malden as a place that, oh, it makes sense to live here.
Like, but they have been, you know, moving up Massachusetts Avenue out into Arlington like the locusts that they are, and you know, destroying everything in their path.
I mean, I was just talking about Quincy in our last segment. It's the same thing. It's like Southie got taken over, that bled into Dorchester. What's the next thing after Dorchester? Quincy.
Yeah.
And it's just, I was going to say,
nobody can figure out where Milton is. Yeah. That's the main reason.
Oh, Milton purposely is difficult to find.
Like nobody knows where Milton is.
Milton doesn't want to be touched.
Am I in Milton? I don't know if I'm in Milton. Where is Milton?
Half the time I'll be in the Blue Hills and I'm like, I think if I turn here, I'm just like in Milton all of a sudden. But if I don't, then, you know, I'm in the wilderness for 3 days.
I hope this rent control thing goes away and goes away quickly because it bad. Rent control, bad. That's all you need to know. Bad. And if you need to know the reasons why rent control bad, ask somebody who understands economics and city planning and those sorts of things, and they'll tell you rent control bad. You're a baseball girl.
I am indeed.
Right? I assume you heard the news coming out of Fenway Park earlier today that after a lot of discussion, apparently, Alex Cora and the Red Sox management have parted ways, which is the 2020 way of saying you fired guy.
Yep. And a lot of this surrounded an incident in 2017 in a sign-stealing scheme that the Houston Astros used in the World Series. And him basically, who's that guy back in the day? Benedict Arnold?
Yes.
That guy? Yeah. Alex Cora, Benedict Arnold of the Boston Red Sox.
You know, the thing that's great about the Astros story is that they're banging on a trash can to let people know, like, the guys in the dugout were the ones that knew what the signals were.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd worked out a code where they'd beat on a trash can with a bat to let the batter know, oh, you know, one bang for a fastball, two bangs for a slider, whatever it was. So the Astros...
I've got to say, living in 2020, I really love like the very primal... Like that's such a primal thing to take place in this day and age. Like, don't have every batter wear a Bluetooth that you like whisper into.
You can't, because here's the thing. In 2017, the Red Sox got busted because they were using an Apple Watch in the dugout to send messages. You're not allowed to have cell phones in the dugout. So they were using an Apple Watch to text stolen signals into the dugout, were then being relayed to the batter out on the field. Now,
still so funny.
In Houston,
as like it's going to be a fastball.
In Houston,
ay.
And I got to go through all the details of this. Following that revelation that the Red Sox got caught, because sign stealing is legal in baseball. Sign stealing is as old as baseball, and it's perfectly legal to do. But Commissioner Rob Manfred has said you cannot use electronic devices to steal signs in any way, shape, or form. And after the Red Sox got caught with the Apple Watch, he specifically sent out a mandate to all Major League Baseball teams saying no electronic sign stealing. None. This is the same. Now, around this same time, Alex Cora is having a television installed in the bullpen. I think it was in the dugout. Mm. Was having it with a live feed from center field so that they could steal signs and then bang on the trash can and let the guy at home plate know what's going on. This evolved when he came, and they won the World Series.
Yeah.
This evolved when he came to the Red Sox. He had somebody in the replay booth figuring out what the signs were, and then they would walk down to the dugout and tell people what the signs were. And then depending on how the base runners stood, that would be the signal to the batter. Hands on hips means fastball. Hands crossed means slider.
Yeah, like basically like signals within the signals.
But you're doing exactly what the commissioner of baseball told you not to do. And it's the Red Sox.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we're a very traditional team, if you...
Well, here's the thing. In 1 week, we've gone from being Titletown to being Cheatersville. And that's what we are now.
Which, I mean...
Everyone in the rest of the country is still up in arms about the things that the Patriots
may or may not have gotten away with. That's the thing, is that it used to be... it used to be that the Red Sox were the... I don't want to say pure, but like the rest of the country viewed the Red Sox as very traditional, very like... they're what this game is all about kind of team. And like in the good sense, in the very classic picturing guys playing in the 30s sense.
There are four teams in Major League Baseball that are the standard. And are when people think about baseball, they think about one of these four teams.
Sox, Yankees, Dodgers.
Not even the Dodgers, because they used to be the Brooklyn Dodgers.
That's true.
There's the Chicago Cubs.
I would say the Cubs.
The Chicago White Sox. Also known as the Black Sox, the New York Yankees, and the Boston Red Sox. And if you're in the southern part of the country, you can throw the Texas Rangers in there. But for mostly, you think baseball, you think the two Chicago teams, you think New York, you think Boston.
Yeah.
They are the most storied franchises and the most universally beloved franchises in all of baseball. The Red Sox have a very special place in people's hearts because they went for so long without winning, because they are not the Yankees. Yeah. A lot of people don't like the tough-nosed, aggressive Yankee style of baseball.
Well, and not... I'm saying this in a very positive way. Anyone who listens to the show knows that I love the Red Sox. I would never say anything disparaging about them. But you compare, same with the city of Boston, but you compare Boston to New York and the Red Sox to the Yankees, everybody loves an underdog. We are definitely the underdog to New York's, you know, quarterback, if you will. Yeah. Or big man. Like, New York's like the big man on campus in baseball, and the Red Sox are the one that get a good punch and sock them in the eye, you know?
Yeah. So, as a fan... I'm profoundly disappointed in this. I mean, the 2018 World Series, as far as I'm concerned, we didn't deserve.
Mm.
We shouldn't have been. Apparently, they didn't cheat in the World Series itself. Oh, good.
But to get there.
You cheated your way there. You won a record number of games that season. The bats were incredibly hot that season. And we're sitting around in 2019 wondering what happened to this team. Well, I guess they stopped cheating. And they came back down to earth. Is there any other way to look at this?
Well, and the thing that's really unfortunate about this, beyond the label that the Red Sox are getting, is, I mean, it's like, I'm trying to think. It's like in Enron, and you think of Enron, what do you think of? You think of all the corrupt people, insider trading,
I think of
all of that stuff.
There papers were, being shredded.
There were probably some honest guys that worked at Enron and who were working their butts off, honestly. But if they ever, on their resume, if it says that they worked at Enron, you're not going to think about that. No. You're going to automatically say, cheaters.
Yeah.
And that's the way it is with this. I mean, you think about all the Red Sox players who, if they didn't have no idea what was going on, at least looked the other way and didn't participate. These people who just came, did their job, did what they were being paid for fairly and honestly. It's like it just completely... It completely takes the value and takes the honor out of that because I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but it devalues it.
But here's one thing that annoys me about all of this.
Just one?
Is, you know, they've circled the wagons and thrown Alex Cora to the wolves. And Alex Cora is the mastermind of both of these schemes.
Mm-hmm.
Deserves every bit of it. He's not going to get a lifetime ban. I suspect he's going to get an indeterminate suspension. You know, he's going to be indefinitely suspended from baseball.
Well, and who's going to want to sign him after this?
3 or 4 years from now, maybe they'll let him come back. He's the mastermind behind this. But he, on his own, could not execute these schemes. The players are willing participants, okay? And if you are a player and you are aware, and I find it hard to believe that the players weren't aware... Mm. That Major League Baseball had banned electronic stealing of signs. The players are guilty. Every player who participated in this, who knew what was going on, is guilty. And really, there ought to be some punishment handed down to those players as well. Because as a player, you could put your hand up and say, hey, that's cheating. And we've had at least one Red Sox player anonymously since this story broke in The Athletic come forward and say, yeah, that was cheating.
Well,
where were you when that was going on?
Well, the difficult thing about that is, I mean, like I was talking about, especially the Red Sox, baseball as a franchise, as a sport, as what it is very traditional and very, I can't think of the word I'm looking for. It just very much it holds certain values that go back a really long time. And it is a bit of a conundrum. I can picture being, okay, well, I know this is wrong, but am I going to betray my entire team and call them out?
But this is the thing. There is, they call it the blue wall of silence, you know, with the police, right?
Yeah.
There is a baseline of silence in Major League Baseball that has allowed these scandals to crop up, whether we're talking about gambling on games, which Pete Rose was doing, whether we're talking about the doping scandal with the cream and the clear that was rampant throughout Major League Baseball.
I remember that.
Or whether we're talking about electronic sign stealing. You know, sooner or later, you got to set it up so that people can drop a dime on the GM and be like, look, you might want to take a look at this TV that they just installed in the dugout. Or you might want to take a look at how people are banging on this trash can over here.
Well,
or maybe people shouldn't be wearing Apple Watches in the dugout. If you sit back and let it happen, you're complicit. And I understand it's a brotherhood. I understand you're close-knit. I understand you're all pulling for the same thing. But when you get caught, you can't just blame it all on this one guy and then try and scurry away. The players are responsible. The players bear some guilt in this.
Well, and I think...
Unless they were... But they knew. Hey, if this guy's standing this way, you do that. Where are you getting the signals from? Don't ask that question.
Well, and I think that I think that that will undeniably affect this coming season as well. Just in terms of...
Cora's gone. The Sox will get fined $5 million because that's the most they can be fined. They'll lose draft picks. We know the punishment is going to be probably harsher than what the Astros got because that was a first offense for them.
Well, I mean, I don't even mean like... I mean, under the surface, the general just vibe, energy of the Red Sox is going to be off this year.
Oh, yeah.
It's regardless of even if the team were to, you know, to still have just as quality players, just as quality everything. I mean, you can't come back from this without eating some proverbial crow. You know what I mean? Like it's almost like I don't think they'll make it to the World Series this coming season or even the playoffs just based on the mentality that is going to be behind all of this season. And now that all of this has come out,
I'm saying everything that I'm saying as a fan.
I was going to say I love the Red Sox. One of my earliest memories is my dad bringing me to a game, us sitting in one of the boxes up above the first baseline and in the upper deck, like being a little 3-year-old and peeking my little head through the bars, and like it breaks my heart that there ever be anything disparaging said about the Red Sox. But that being said, I mean, you can't ignore this. You can't, I mean, this is the worst thing they've done since they traded Babe Ruth.
I still love Mookie Betts.
I mean, how can you not?
I still love Mookie Betts, but
how can you not love Mookie Betts?
Oh, 2018 is ruined for me. Absolutely ruined. That should make noise.
I'm going to say, make some noise.
There's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather.
Your Boston 5-day forecast tonight. If you're way, way, way out in the sticks, beware of black ice. There's going to be some rain moving through late. Temperatures in the mid-30s, low 30s in some parts of the state. Tomorrow's going to be the fun one. Light rain during the morning, temperatures in the mid-40s, and then the temperatures fall into the teens tomorrow night.
Oof.
Yeah, so don't take...
I guess I'm turning my heat back on.
Don't take them mild temperatures tomorrow morning as anything other than a cruel tease by nature. Friday, we're going to be in the mid-20s with a lot of wind blowing around. Temperatures in the teens again Friday night. Saturday, afternoon snow showers. How much? We don't know. Maybe a little, maybe a lot. High and low are both going to be around freezing on Saturday. And then Sunday, mostly sunny, high in the low 40s, but lows in the 20s in the city Sunday night. Teens in the suburbs. The teens are out in the suburbs, and that is always bad news for everyone who lives there. 855-915-9636. When we come back, that pretty much wraps it up for the big picture. We're going to be talking about movies. Oscar nominations are out. There are good movies for you to go and see in the theater. We're going to get you caught up on all of that right after this here on WMFO Medford.
wholesomeness, quality, convenience, value for your dollar. These are just a few things to consider when you're buying beef for your freezer. Basically, you have three choices. You can buy beef as a side or a quarter, you can buy wholesale cuts, or you can choose retail cuts. And deciding which to buy, you should consider the amount of beef you can store in your freezer, the amount your family can use in a reasonable time, and the kinds of meat your family enjoys. If your family likes steak, for example, it's probably best to buy a large quantity of the kind they like when it's a featured special at your retail store. A side of beef, on the other hand, will give you about one-third steaks, one-third roast, and one-third stew or ground beef. If you want to learn more about buying meat for your freezer, we have some free information. Write How to Buy Meat, Agriculture Radio, Washington, D.C., 20250.
This is the sound of salmonella gyrating on your undercooked chicken. And it looks like Mom might be taking it out a little early. Don't let salmonella get funky with your chicken. On average, 1 in 6 Americans will get a foodborne illness this year. So use a thermometer to cook each type of meat to the right temperature. Keep your family safe at foodsafety.gov. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair. But her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's the
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. What are we calling this now?
I don't know what we're calling this.
It's sort of the big picture.
It's the moving picture. We'll call it the moving picture for now.
The moving picture. I'm Shay Spillane.
Continuity here.
With me, as always, is Derek Gary. We're going to be here with you till 9 o'clock. If you want to give us a call at 855-915-W.